Hi, this is Curl Bro, and I support Gen X Grown Up on Patreon, and you should too. And if you don't, I hope you leave enough room for my fists, because I'm going to ram it in your stomach and break your spine. Just go to genxgrownup.com/Patreon to sign up today.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown up?
Gen X Grown Up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up.
Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown up.
Welcome back, Gen X Grown Up Podcast listener, to another Backtrack edition of the Gen X Grown Up Podcast. The Backtrack is where we take a single nostalgic topic we all remember growing up as Gen Xers and dig in deep. I am John. Joining me as always is Mo.
Hey, everybody.
And of course, George is here with us.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
If you were a kid in the 70s or 80s, like us, and you ever built a little ramp in your backyard so you could do bicycle stunts, odds are pretty good you were inspired by the king of the daredevil stuntmen. In this Backtrack, we are taking an in-depth look at the life, career, and legacy of self-made, death-defying superstar, the one and only Evel Knievel.
Wow.
We have had listeners who have definitely written in multiple times saying, when are you going to talk about Evel Knievel? What about my stunt cycle? What about the daredevil? And we finally gotten there. It's on our agenda. Before we get into talking all about Evel Knievel, though, it is time for one of our favorite parts of the show. That is fourth listener email. And this time around, long time listener, Chad.
Oh, hey, Chad. Wow.
Yeah. Subject line of his email is from our most recent Backtrack, sequels better than the originals that we just did. Tons of feedback over a Discord about that one, too. I think that's another one that really resonated.
We had to give up definitions of sequels, even.
Yeah.
A sequel doesn't necessarily mean the second film.
That's right.
Right.
Could be just any follow-up. Yeah, right?
Right.
Yeah. People splitting hairs and disagreeing, and that's good. That's what we're here for.
Good topic for discussion, right?
We like it. Yep.
Friendly debate.
So Chad listened to that episode, and he wrote in to say, no mention of The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, man. Chad, you're dead to me.
Come on now. You're dead to me.
Wow.
Goodness. Come on.
That was quick.
It went from zero
to 100.
That's right.
Didn't it?
You were my favorite. Now you're not. No, I get it.
Oh, boy.
A lot of people have that opinion. I think you're all wrong, but I understand the opinion is out there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, we did have that in
debate. Yeah, we had
the
debate.
Actually, we talked about it. You know, and Chad even says, I mean, I know it's been talked about ad nauseum, but still, he felt that Empire deserved a spot on the list.
I agree with Chad.
Yeah. I know you do.
Empire's the better film.
Yeah. Took me a while to get over that. I'm just getting over it.
That would have been the one that we would not have all agreed upon, as is quite evident.
True.
Yeah. He goes on to say, as far as music formats go, I started with cassettes for the most part. I did have one of those Fisher-Price turntables when I was little. That doesn't count.
It only played 45s, doesn't it? No. I think, right?
But yeah, he said, when I really started getting into music as a teenager, cassettes were my main format. My grandfather bought my aunt an $800 CD player.
Wow.
She played me Money from Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. I was blown away with the cash registers and everything. It just sounded so crystal clear. It was amazing.
Yeah.
I can still picture standing in her room listening to that all these years later.
Yep. I had a very similar experience. I mean, that album in particular just sounded so amazing on CD.
Yeah, clean. Dark Side of the Moon, anything like that.
Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, Led Zeppelin. I remember Dire Straits, Money for Nothing.
Oh, yeah.
I had that album, and that sounded good on CD. I'm like, wow, is this what it could be? Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he goes on to say, when the Discman and its no skip technology came along, I could plug it in my car via that fake cassette.
Which I'm still amazed at how that worked.
And that's when I really started collecting music. Of course, now I only buy vinyl and the occasional cassette, but CD was a major touchstone in my life. Not that I'm alone there, for sure. You definitely are not.
Nope.
He wraps it up by saying, may the fourth listener be with you, Chad. Cool. Thanks,
nice.
Chad.
Thank you, Chad.
Hey, we appreciate you writing in, Chad. We love it every time the fourth listener writes in. If you'd like your email featured here on the show, it's easy. Just hit us up at podcast@genxgrownup.com. Read every single one, and most of them, like Chad's, are going to make the show. All right. We get back from the break. We are jumping into the life and times of stuntman Evel Knievel. Stick around. Over the past few weeks, we've been trying out Factor Meals, and they're meals that come straight to your door. They deliver them to you in the mail. They drop on the front door in this freezer pack. And it's a great way to eat stress-free. And this spring, you can get delicious, ready-to-eat meals. They're fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, and dietitian-approved. And here's the cool thing, as we've all found out. You throw them in the microwave for 2 minutes, and they're ready to eat and not even requiring cleanup.
And if you can't find something on their menu that you like, then you're just way too picky, mm-hmm. because they have over 35 options. Mm. You know, they have things like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Vegan, Veggie, and we even tried the vegetarian one, which was really good.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just the regular meals, but they've also got all these add-on packs, which I really love. These are things like, you know, breakfast or on-the-go lunches or little snacks, even like beverages that want to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So really, I mean, like they say on their site, what are you waiting for? And they're not kidding. You can get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals by heading over to Factor.
Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring.
Are you looking for good gourmet meals? Try the meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus.
Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff.
Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle.
Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking.
We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for lowest carbon footprint meals.
So head to factormeals.com/GenX50 and use code GenX50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code GenX50 at factormeals.com/GenX50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Be sure to subscribe to or follow Gen X Grown Up wherever you listen. And while you're there, rate and review the show, too. It helps more than you know.
See Evel Knievel, starring George Hamilton and Sue Lyon.
Well, I do two pickup trucks in the end.
That's 40 feet, boy.
That's right.
See Evel's most spectacular jump at Caesar's Palace.
Hold it.
Don't miss Evel Knievel. It's dynamite. Evel Knievel, rated GP.
Now playing at the Uptown Theater, 3426 Connecticut Avenue Northwest.
It is finally time. If you have been writing and asking us to talk about Evel Knievel, your day is here. It's time on the backtrack. And Evel Knievel, of course, that was his show name. We're talking about Robert Craig Knievel.
I still believe Knievel was his actual last name. That still blows me away, too.
Right. If you had to guess which of those was his real name.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Why would you have thought Evel was his real name over Knievel, though? I mean, that's not even close to anybody's real name.
It just seems so unlikely that either of those are real names, actually. Not that you mentioned it.
Yeah.
He would have been 83 years old right around this time. His birthday was October 17th. Born in 1938. So we thought here, celebrating his birthday, it was a great time to talk about Evel Knievel. And we all, in preparation for this backtrack, learned a lot about the man that we didn't already know. But before we get into any of that, I want to start with a round robin question. When we all knew Evel Knievel first and best, like around toward the end of his career, like in 1980, we were all kids. I want to know your perception of the man. How did you think of him? How did you relate to his kind of his fandom and his legacy? I'd like to start with you, George. What did you think of Evel Knievel as a kid?
And when I was a kid, I mean, I just thought he was like this crazy guy who jumped big buses and jumped over stuff on his motorcycle. And then very quickly, his most famous toy, the little stunt cycle thing, came out. And every kid at my school and neighborhood wanted one. I never got one. I don't think any of my friends ever got one. We all wanted one. But yeah, I mean, I just knew him, I guess I'd say, more as a toy than as a real person.
Mm. Yeah. So just like the figure of who he was rather than who he was.
Right.
Well, very similar for me, I think, which was I didn't know much about him. I remember my dad loved to watch The Wide World of Sports and he was on there many times. And I see stock footage and I'm like, I remember watching that on TV. Mm-hmm. I do. Even though I wasn't paying attention to the news. I didn't know what he was planning to do or what was coming up next for him. But when I saw him, I knew I was in for something that I would not see anyone else do because he was crazy. Like he was doing things that obviously seemed like he was going to die, and yet it never killed him somehow. So I just saw him as, I wouldn't say a hero, but he was definitely larger than life. It was a character.
Sure.
He was huge. What about you, Mo?
Yeah. For me, I guess I always, I just always imagined that his home life was like him and his whole family riding around motorcycles, jumping things all the time. You know, it's almost like not like a real person. You know what I mean?
Like the Partridge Family of stunts.
Exactly. Because like, I think like you said, George, like he was almost like not a real person. I think that's what the image he was trying to convey, right? That he's bigger than life and all that stuff. And definitely as a kid, I was like, wow, like if he, I never actually met him in person, but if he like knew he was somebody who's nearby, I'm sure like we would have flocked there and went his autograph and everything else. I mean, he was like a pretty major celebrity.
Well, yeah, I mean, a real person would die from the things he was doing. That's what I thought at that point, because nobody did the stuff that he did before we saw him do it, or at least before I saw him do it. So to me, he was almost, yes, he was that toy that, you know, when you're a kid, your toy is indestructible and you can jump it over things and throw it into a wall and it pops back up and you're like, oh, he's still alive, you know, and you're happy about your character. But I saw him that way, almost like he was a modern superhero, you know, like a Superman or a Spider-Man or something along those lines. And then he had the flamboyant outfits that I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. And even at one point started wearing a damn cape. So I thought he was a superhero.
That's the point. Well, he did live to the ripe old age of 69. Not that old by today's standards. He passed away in 2007.
They say it's not the years, it's the mileage.
Literally and figuratively for this guy.
No kidding. No kidding. It's worth noting that he didn't die from any injury or complication of old injuries. He died of historically old age diseases, diabetes and pulmonary fibrosis. Old age diseases. Now, he wasn't that old. He clearly had been put his body through hell.
I would bet his lifestyle contributed to those diseases grabbing him a lot earlier than he should have.
Sure. You talk about like this whole like superhero bigger than life thing. To me, that was one of the things like how he always, no matter how he got injured, he always came back. Like it seemed like it didn't affect him hardly.
Right. Yeah. Broken back, broken ribs, broken legs. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And like a week later, he'd be on the news. Like on a talk show or something. And you're like, wait a minute, did he just break his hip or did he like fracture something?
Well, and yeah, and you're talking about the 70s at this point, right? The 60s, 70s. So people didn't heal from those kind of injuries as quickly as they might now, thanks to modern medicine. Yeah. I mean, before you broke your leg in the 70s, your shit was done for 6 months. That was it.
You'd think, right?
But this guy, you're right, Mo, he would, it was like he was on Wide World of Sports. He would crash this horrific, horrible crash that you knew he was just dead, but he survived somehow. Yeah. And you're like, okay, we won't see him until like the 80s. But no, he would come back like a week later, two weeks later, and he'd be on the show, maybe on with his little cane or something, or maybe a neck brace around his neck.
On Carson.
And he'd be talking to whoever he was going to talk to and setting up the next thing he was going
to
do.
And that could only have contributed to that perception that he's a superhero. I mean, no, a normal person wouldn't be on TV the next week. He'd be one of those full body casts with the pulleys and everything in the bed. That's where he ought to be, right? Well, they say that during his career, he could have suffered as many as 433 fractures.
Jeez.
In the Guinness Book of World Record, that's he's in there for most bones broken, survivor of most bones broken in a lifetime.
I hope they're not like taking new entries for that record, though. I hope they've closed that category down, because that would lend some crazy person to try and, oh, I'm going to break 444 bones.
It's rumored that that could be an exaggerated number. In fact, his son Robbie Knievel told a reporter later that his father had broken between 40 and 50 bones, and at one time Evil Knievel said it was around 35, which sounds pretty low to me.
I think that sounds on the low end.
I
mean, it sounds low for his activities, but it's not low for a human.
For a person. Listen, if I break one, I'm a baby. 35 is the end of me.
Exactly.
Right. Probably out of the three of us, I would venture to guess that I may have broken more bones than either of you two.
I have zero, so you definitely broke more than me.
I've broken each one of my fingers twice. I've broken my arms, my legs. I've broken a rib. I've cracked three vertebrae in my back. So I've had some broken bones.
Well, are you in Guinness?
Yeah, no, I'm not.
No, 432. He's one below Evil. Sorry.
Right. Every one of those breaks, though, they would really hurt. And that's a lot of pain to go through. And even something as simple as breaking a finger, that's some painful shit.
Yeah.
And this guy would get back up and ride a motorcycle, which is all the vibrations going through your body with a broken bone. No, bullshit. I'm not doing that.
One thing about his early life, he created this event, this persona, this whole thing himself. Like, nothing like this ever existed before him.
He created the death-defying stunt. You could say all the X Games came out of Evel Knievel. All this extreme sports of any kind wasn't really a thing. Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, he made it into a spectacle, and he could turn the jump, which lasts all of what, 5 seconds maybe, into a 2-hour thing where everybody's there and these people are speculating.
Because he gets up and gives a speech, and then he runs up the ramp 3 or 4 times like he's judging it, which was all bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't judging anything.
He'd done the math already. Yeah.
No, he didn't even do the math. We watched the documentary, and he was like, it was all gut feeling. Yeah. Nowadays, if you're going to do a stunt like that, they've got like physics people on the sideline who are calculating your optimal velocity and takeoff and angle.
They probably put an X on the ramp and say, hey, you're going to land exactly there. You know?
This guy just like, all right, let's put together some wood and I think I'm going to land about there. So put some dirt over there and we'll see what happens. It was like us in our side yard when you were building a little ramp for your bicycle and your friends. It was the same kind of thing.
With ramps done, you guys all lay down there. I'm sure it'll work. It's fine.
Right. What could go wrong?
Right.
Well, we were making fun of his name. Which one was a real name, Evel or Knievel? His genuine last name was Knievel. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit about where he actually got that nickname Evel. It had to do with the, he was a bit of a rapscallion as a youngster.
That's one way of putting it.
He was a fucking criminal. That's what it got to do with.
Let's try to be nice.
Let's do it. So we all did some research for this, and he was a arch criminal as a young person. That's all there is to it. I mean, he grew up in Butte, Montana. Mm-hmm. Butte, Montana was known that people lived poor, hard, everyday working man lives. And he wanted money. He wanted fame. And the only way to get that was doing some illegal stuff. So he ends up in jail one night, Mo, right? He's in jail with another guy who's a similar ilk, and the policeman decided to have a little bit of fun.
Yeah. Apparently he was in jail for stealing a motorcycle. Go figure. Mm, right.
That makes sense. Checks out.
And then he crashed it, and then he was taken to jail. And they said the jailer liked to give people nicknames. And the person he was in with was like William Knoffel. So they called him Awful Knoffel.
Right. Yeah.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
And then Knievel. Oh, Evel Knievel. You know, which makes sense. I mean, it does rhyme.
So we've got Awful Knoffel and Evel Knievel.
Exactly.
In the jail tonight.
In the jail tonight. And after Evel Knievel crashed a motorcycle, which is just, that was foretelling of his future.
Right.
Yeah. That lines up.
Yeah. But he didn't spell it the way you traditionally spell the word Evel, even though that's what the jailer gave him the nickname with. He spelled it the same way his last name, the last four letters of his last name, Knievel, E-V-E-L.
Right.
He spelled evil that same way. So that's where the rhyming really takes forth. And apparently he did it because he didn't want to seem too evil to the fans.
Too scary.
I'm
too demonic.
Is anybody going to notice the difference of that? They're going to say the word. They're not going to notice that the E and the I are different.
Right. So. Oh, are you Satan? No, it's pronounced Satan. No. Right. Nothing. Not a big deal. You got to check the spelling to see what you're evil or not.
But also, I know his early life, he was a talker, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he worked as a salesman for a while, was super successful. And basically, I think he told the guy that he'll break all the records if the guy promised him like this big promotion, and the guy wouldn't agree to it.
Yeah, what did an insurance company or something? Yeah. Like he sold insurance, and he went to like a psych ward or something like that, a psychiatry hospital, and sold like 200 plus policies in one day.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, of course you sold 200 insurance policies in a psych ward in one day.
That was smart, right? And then the guy wouldn't promise him that. So he's like, oh, well, he quit. And then I think after that, he started doing the whole motorcycle thing.
It was always about trying to expand his sphere of notoriety. He started off with a group of people doing stunts at one point. That didn't work out business-wise. So then he decided to do it on his own because it was more economical and he could make promises and keep all the money to himself because, as we know, the man was a criminal, like we were saying.
Yeah.
So even when he had that group of people, like some of the last stunts they all did together, he just took the money and ran. He didn't give them anything. This was not a good person when he was first starting out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those stunts are really, that's when he came into his own. And that's when we started to know him as a public figure. So when we get back from this break, we're going to dive into the origin of his career and talk about those stunts. Stick around.
What was it like to be there for historical sports moments and unforgettable performances? To be behind the scenes? On Press Box Access, you'll hear from me, Todd Jones, and other sports writers about their experiences with the greatest athletes, coaches, and sports events of the past half century. We'll share some stories behind the stories, some big, some small, and some we've only told each other. Let us buy you a round on Press Box Access.
You're listening to Gen X Grown Up. But if you have a friend who's not yet listening, why not? Tell them about us. They'll thank you later.
Okay, partner.
Get scared of dying,
Do I ever get scared of thinking about dying? Yeah. Well, I do. I get concerned, you might say. I don't get scared. I don't want to die because I have two little boys that remind me of you and a little girl that's smaller than you are. And I don't want to die and leave their mommy and leave them. But I am convicted to do this thing because I want to do it.
I don't think anybody knows Evel Knievel for anything other than stunts. So there's no way we're going to do this podcast without having an entire section on the stunts that he accomplished, or at least attempted to accomplish, throughout his career. This guy started in 1965, which was before any of us were born. Mo, you were born 67, right?
Yep, correct.
So he was doing stunts before we were born, but he started getting super, super popular right around the beginning of the 70s. The late 60s, the early 70s. It's when, John, you mentioned earlier the ABC Wild World of Sports. He just started calling those guys up and pretending to be different people. Have you heard of Evel Knievel? Have you heard of Evel Knievel? Hey, have you heard of Evel Knievel? You know, and just building himself up. But the one thing that gets me that I didn't think about, I was a kid. Who knows?
Right.
But he did 90% of his stunts on heavy bikes, Harley Davidson.
Like street bikes. Yeah.
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 Whereas the kids that do the X Games and all the big 500-foot jumps and flip 40 million times or whatever in the air, they're doing them on the smaller.
They're like finely tuned.
Like the Kawasaki's or the Honda, the smaller bikes with more power.
Mm-hmm. Lighter.
Yeah. Lighter bikes. Right. Exactly. Him doing these stunts that he did on these heavy bikes is a large part of the reason why his stunts were so epic and sometimes epic failures.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Those bikes are not designed to go airborne and then hit the ground with that kind of impact.
Yeah.
That's why they would break the back of the bike. And later he picked up another bike. He didn't do the math. Like you said, he's like,
right.
Oh, this bike works. It's got a motor. Let's give it a shot.
Right.
Can I get to 100 miles an hour? Yeah, that's like all he cared about.
That's right.
And he always promoted that Harley Davidson brand.
Yeah,
he
would. They were a sponsor, I think.
He would say, I'd like to thank Harley Davidson for always providing me the bikes and supporting me throughout all my jumps. So he wasn't a great guy, as we talked about personally, but he was loyal to his sponsors and the people that helped him to make money.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a shrewd self-promoter.
Oh, yeah, very much
so. Nefariously self-promoting often, but he was shrewd. He absolutely knew how to work the system. In the course of his career, that was 15 years? Yeah, 65 to 80 was his performing career. He made over 75 ramp jumps between bikes and rocket sleds that we'll talk about later and other stuff. Of those, 19 resulted in injury.
Yeah, I'm surprised that number's not higher. Honestly.
That's not a great ratio.
But still, I expected that number to be 45 out of 75. Right? He broke something. Because you ever see his landings. We're going to talk about some of his stunts specifically. But there's one landing in particular that we're going to talk about the stunt in a little while. And I remember as a kid seeing that stunt on TV with my father, who, after watching the documentary that we watched, I've decided that my father very easily would have been Evel Knievel had he been into motorcycles instead of pool playing. Those two guys were the same kind of hustling salesmen, self-promotion people that could make you believe in any fact they thought was real. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Hustler is the perfect term. That was the term I was looking for before. He was definitely a hustler.
Oh yeah, for sure. Talk about some of his stunts. His very first one that McKenna credit him with was he would jump over boxes of rattlesnakes, and he did mountain lions, and that was because he worked at a motorcycle garage, and he said, hey, he convinced the owner that if we do these stunts in front of the garage, it'll drum up business.
Again, hustler.
He would jump over just random things, and of course this is a small town, everyone's gonna go watch that because what else is there to do?
And what do you have plenty of in Montana? Rattlesnakes and mountain lions, apparently, because that's something. I mean, what else are you gonna jump over? I guess it's not, he's not Happy Days with the fawns jumping over a shark tank or something.
Although he did have a shark stunt later, but we'll talk about that
later. Of course he did.
Did he do a shark jump?
Of course he did.
Shark jump. Wow.
So, well, he did actually do it, but yeah, there was a planned one.
His first one was just like a 20-foot jump there at the motorcycle place, right? It was not a big deal.
But 20 feet, if I was there and saw a motorcycle, that especially that size motorcycle go 20 feet, I think I'd be like, wow.
Oh, still impressive. Oh, no, I'm not minimizing it.
Well, yeah, because nobody was doing that at that point.
That's
like,
right.
Motorcycles were designed to be ridden around. Mm-hmm. Nobody thought about jumping those things before he really did that on a big scale.
You probably avoid jumps, right?
Yeah.
His next recorded jump was a year later in 66 in California, and he jumped two pickup trucks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's moving up. And that was actually the first time he used the moniker Evel Knievel. Prior to that, he was just, hey, there's this guy, and he wasn't really setting up a persona for himself.
Here's Rattlesnake Mountain Lion jumping guy.
Here's Rattlesnake Robert Craig, you know, just making stuff up, right? But now he's stepping it up and creating that brand.
Yeah. Well, also, I think it was the sponsor for that jump also didn't like Robert Knievel. He's like, what else he got?
Yeah.
How about Evel Knievel? He's like, oh, that's it. But with an E, because I'm not that evil.
I had a jailer name me that. How about that? Sounds great.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. And that brings us, George, I think to the one you were alluding to is that one I think everybody saw. Now, not all, we didn't all see it live because this happened in 67.
Right.
But this is the jumping the fountains at Caesar's Palace.
Yep.
Right. And that's the one that, you know, he did one of those PR stunts again, where he's calling the people at Caesar's as other people to try and
like
get
news
himself
and stuff.
Permission to jump over the fountains, you know. And
he started advertising to broadcasters that he was going to jump the fountains before he got permission to jump the fountains.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he made a fake company and started calling Caesar's, mispronouncing his own name.
Right.
Hey, have you heard about this like Devil Bedevil guy or something?
Evel, he's supposed Evel to jump Knievel. Or whatever.
Yeah. And he drummed up his own demand. And then when he showed up and said, I'm Evel Knievel, they're like, well, we need you because everybody wants to see you.
Yeah, that was pretty brilliant.
That's pure hustler right there. And to do the little subtle things in that hustle for believability, mispronouncing your own name.
Oh, yeah.
Genius. Having a corporation and everything. And
evil genius.
Getting all the media to be the people to demand him to be able to do the jump.
Mm-hmm.
It's just mind-boggling. You don't see that kind of marketing now unless it's done by a PR firm. And they all think they're clever. And I'm like, this sumbitch was doing it in the late 60s.
Yeah, with just a phone.
You guys got nothing over Evel Knievel. And he got it all set up. He does the jump. Oh. And I remember watching, not at the time because I wasn't born in 67, but I remember seeing replays of it with my father later on when I was a young kid. And that one clip that everybody talks about, the landing, where it's the camera's face on of his landing.
Yep.
And he hits that landing ramp and the bike literally is just ripped out of his hands from the impact and the velocity.
And then he goes tumbling over
and
the
handlebars.
He goes
tumbling over it forwards and he's just a rag doll as he slides across the pavement and everything. They always had on Wide World of Sports, Agony of Defeat, and it was the skier that would fall down.
Ski jump out. Yeah, of course.
I always thought it should have been Evel Knievel instead.
Yeah, really?
That was the Agony of Defeat, if you saw anything. I mean, that was a horrific crash.
It was. It was terrible. Almost all of these things I found YouTube clips for, so they'll all be in the show notes if people want to see the...
Oh, excellent.
I mean, you'd say he's a hustler, but at the end, though, I mean, he did... try to do the jump. It was like he took the money and run.
Well, hustler doesn't mean you don't follow through necessarily.
Right.
Hustler just means that you talk people into something they didn't know they wanted.
Right.
Right.
And then are not mad that they paid for it afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's not a fraud. He's just a hustler. Yeah,
right.
For sure. You know, George, you talk about that footage of him tumbling over the handlebars.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Evel wanted to record a documentary of his jump over the fountain. So he hired a young filmmaker, John Derrick, to film it. One of the people holding a camera was his wife, Linda Evans. She is the woman holding the camera.
Linda Evans, the actress?
The actress, Linda Evans, is the person holding the camera of that landing. Yep. That's so famous.
That's crazy.
Ouch.
And after that crash, I would say that cemented Evel Knievel's career. From then on, he was stratospheric. He was incredible.
Yeah. Everyone wants to see him crash again.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's the same, you know, mentality of watching NASCAR events. Do you watch it for guys to drive around on a right-hand turn for 500 miles? No. You watch it to see the spectacular crash, and that's what most people go to a NASCAR event for. But Evel Knievel was doing that at the same time, but on an individual basis. And you're right. You put that on TV, that's compelling.
Yeah.
When you're driving down the highway and you can't turn your head away from the horrible accident that you see on the side of the road, it's the same type of feeling that you get when you see Evel Knievel getting ripped off of that motorcycle and tumbling feet over head into the pavement. It's brutal.
It's the danger. We want him to succeed, but we know there's a chance we might watch him die.
better than average chance with this guy.
There's a shot. We might see that. So it makes a spectacle.
After that Caesars one, I mean, he was in a hospital for almost a month.
Which should have been almost a year.
Yeah, right.
But
really.
We say almost a month because it's Evel Knievel. They talk in that documentary. He apparently had some kind of crazy pain threshold that he could get up and keep going even after these horrible accidents.
But they said he had broken ribs, he had a broken hip, and his other side of the hip was crushed. Which, nothing about that sounds fun.
Crushed. Ugh.
I mean, ribs alone. Have you ever had a broken rib? I'm telling you.
I've had a cracked rib, and I was on my back for a week.
That's not, you just breathe, and it's like every movement hurts.
Yep. But here's the thing that just blew me away. His next jump was May the following year.
Holy hell.
5 months later, he jumps again, crashes, by the way, breaks his leg and fractures his foot.
He doesn't want anybody to forget about him, right?
Yeah,
he's like,
exactly.
We watched that guy. He crashed. I guess that's over. Oh, no. He gets right back up, gets back on the horse, right?
Then he did it again in August. I mean, I was like, what the hell?
Bananas.
He did make it after that, though. He didn't crash after that one.
Well, that's good.
He was okay.
Well, let's see. So fast forward a little bit. We got to 1971. That's when he did the Madison Square Garden jump over 9 cars and a van.
That was also televised. I think that was one of the ones in the Wild World of Sports. It was a lot of build up to it because it's also New York now, big time.
So the Caesar's Palace wasn't televised?
No, he was recording a documentary for it later. It wasn't live.
I only saw replays later on. Yeah. Like I said, okay, I got you.
Mm-hmm.
The one in Madison Square Garden was 9 cars, right? Which, that seems far, right?
That's enough.
Right.
But then he went from 9 to he tried to do 15 cars in 72. That seems like a big jump. And apparently it was a big jump because he crashed.
Well, the average car is what, 4.5 or 5 feet wide at that point?
At least five, probably closer to 6 back then. I mean, those are wide cars.
Okay. So let's go with 5 for easy math.
Yeah.
So it's 75 feet if you did them width-wise and tightened really close together plus the ramp, so maybe 80 feet a damn Harley. Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
right. That's just the car. There's the acceleration, there's the up, and there's the
down,
there's the down, and there's that landing. Oh, yeah,
yeah. And that one, I say he broke his ankle.
Oh.
He got up and walked off with freaking broken ankle.
Unbelievable.
We see athletes doing that kind of stuff too, and there's adrenaline and things of that nature. But athletes, like, they break one bone and they get up, walk off, and then they're on the injured reserve list for like 6 months. And then they come back the next season. This guy breaks his ribs, breaks legs, breaks arms, whatever else, crushes hips. And then 5 months later, he's up jumping again and breaking something.
It keeps going.
Mind-numbingly stupid.
See, in 73 at the Los Angeles Coliseum, he jumped 50 crushed cars in a pile.
Yeah.
So they weren't as wide, but 50, so that's height.
It was higher,
and width of these old crushed cars.
Mm.
That jump was the longest one. It lasted 35 years. As the world record, the longest, furthest, highest jump.
What always got me about his jumps, the thing that as a kid just floored me, was when he would do these ones in these stadiums, there were several of them where he would start at the top of the stadium.
Oh, yeah.
On this really narrow ramp, and he would go down and then back up to the jump. And that narrow ass ramp, as a kid, I always wondered, just make the ramp wider. What the hell are you thinking?
Why is it so narrow?
Right.
How did he never fall off of that? I mean,
exactly.
That's
just
pretty
that
dangerous.
That was an accomplishment.
Yeah. No kidding.
I remember that camera view from like behind his head looking down the ramp, that they always did.
It looks a mile down. It looks tremendous.
It looks like a ski jump. I mean, it just looks like
the worst roller coaster scare you could ever imagine, right? Oh.
Oh, man. Actually, after that one, I think it was when the Snake Canyon came in.
Oh, yeah. Snake Canyon is kind of a signature thing in his career. We're going to give it a whole segment. But there was one real notable one right after that was kind of his comeback from Snake Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that Wembley Stadium. He went to the UK. Stuntmen were not a thing over there at all.
Yeah.
Let's find a new audience.
We're going to talk about it, but he had some bad experiences with the Snake Canyon stunt.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And so he was trying to revive himself a little bit, putting himself in front of a new audience.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he tries to go, 13 buses?
That's right.
Because we're in England. We got to do the buses. But he did do it in Wembley Stadium.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is an iconic stadium for that area.
Of course. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When he went there, the ticket sales were kind of lagging. And of course, he got a motorcycle, started driving around London and all the cities, promoting himself, and they had 90,000 people show up.
Jesus. Well, that's what he did. Remember in that movie in Los Angeles when nobody knew who he was driving up and down Sunset Boulevard doing wheelies right in front of the restaurant where all the press people used to have a weekly luncheon, just so people would know who he was.
What the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
He was the man put in the work. You cannot say he didn't put in the work.
So that jump didn't go well, as you might imagine.
No.
120 feet. Crashes, fractures his damn pelvis, gets up,
walks
off the field with a crushed pelvis.
Craziness.
And then says, "I'm done. This is the last time you'll ever see me. Thank you for coming out."
Yeah.
Bullshit. You know he's coming back.
Then he called him back and said, "Don't air that." I'm like, dude, that was lies. You can't unair that. Yeah. But yeah, he's like, "I'm not retiring.
Can we fix it in the edit?"
Right.
No, we can't.
Now, he did have a concussion too, so maybe that was what the concussion was talking at the moment.
He better have a concussion after that. My goodness.
Jesus.
I know. So he actually did just one more big jump, I think, after that. And that was in 75, right, where he did 14 buses in Ohio, 133 feet.
But that one he made, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he made that one.
He made that one, yeah.
Made that one. And then he said, I think that's it.
And that's what I think. Like, he couldn't go off on a loss, right? Because for a jump, the loss is not being able to land it. But I remember after he makes the jump and he drives the motorcycle back around, he's like showing him, yeah, look, the seat broke in half and blah, blah, blah. But this motorcycle kept me alive. Thank you, Harley Davidson. I'm like, Jesus Christ, man.
Yeah, I'm like, did they modify his motorcycle at all? I don't know. Like special shocks or?
I don't know. I mean, you would think somebody would have asked that, but.
Looking at it, it didn't look modified. I mean, I'm not a motorcycle expert, but it looked like a normal motorcycle.
It looked pretty normal, right? It wasn't like covered with sheet metal or anything crazy. Yeah, it was just a bike. Yeah. Maybe he had some extra welds or something, but it was typical. We said he'd been on the Wild World of Sports, and that was where I first saw him or would see him with my dad. He was on there 7 times. I didn't remember it was that much.
Yeah.
5 of those are in the 20 top most watched stunts of all time.
Like Wild World of Sports segments. They're
Segments. Evans.
That's right. Yeah. Most popular segments of Wild World.
Yep.
5 of those are in the top 20.
That's crazy. So a quarter of the top 20 are him.
It makes sense. What else is as big a spectacle as, who's going to win? Who's going to lose? Is a guy going to die? I mean, it's that kind of like, oh my goodness, I've got to see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Succeed or fail, people wanted to see what this man was going to do. He demanded an audience.
Well, I would take a guess that the one he's most well known for is the one that we're going to talk about in the next segment, right, John?
Yeah, I would think, yeah.
We get right back. We alluded to that Snake Canyon jump. We are going to talk all about that when we get back. Stick around.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey, and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listener survey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
Each episode of Gen X Grown Up has show notes loaded with links where you can learn more about our topics. And there's even more to see and hear over at genxgrownup.com.
This is Evel Knievel and the Evel Knievel Shock Absorbing Stunt Cycle. You can make him do wheelies, backstands, even midair somersaults. And for that big jump, here's Evel, up and over that 4-foot ditch. Evel Knievel, sold separately or with the Evel Knievel Stunt Cycle from Ideal.
We have to talk about Snake Canyon.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
We just promised we would. We've got to now.
Oh, that's true. That's true. We did promise. And we purposely didn't list it with the rest of the stunts because so much was happening. It was so different than anything he ever did before.
Mm-hmm.
He invested a ton of money himself into that.
Mm-hmm.
It was to jump the Snake River Canyon, which is 1,400 feet. Which he supposedly had a, using air quotes here, rocket cycle.
Yeah.
But it really was. It was just really a rocket, but still.
Well, but so I'm going to say this. I've been talking shit about the man the whole time. But the one thing that he did that I am going to give him credit for and that I'm impressed with is that he always kept a promise to his fans. If he said he was going to do a stunt,
he's going to do
by
it.
By God, oh, yeah. He's going to do the stunt. Now, he may take you through some sideshow shenanigans, right? He may do some stuff that we're going to talk about here in Snake Canyon that, you know, not really on the up and up. But by God, he's going to try whatever it was that he promised you. And you're going to, I think you have to give the man credit for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's all part of the show. He's a showman on top of everything else. Yeah. Now, before he did Snake Canyon, he was promising and running his mouth off that he was going to jump the Grand Canyon. Right. That was his thing, right? So he's going to jump it a mile across. He's going to do it. It turned out that the Department of the Interior would not grant him permission. Not permission to jump the Grand Canyon. They wouldn't give him permission to access the airspace over the Grand Canyon for what he wanted to do.
What does the airspace over the canyon have to do with anything?
I think that's just a reason to deny him permission, but you can imagine.
You can touch down on the right side, and you can touch down on the left side, but don't touch the air in between.
You can drive around on both sides, but you cannot fly over it. Not allowed. Not permission. So Snake Canyon was his fallback.
Well, didn't he buy the whole area?
I think he bought the land.
He had to get it. And I'm assuming the airspace as well, right?
Yeah.
I would hope so.
But this was back in September of 74, and his rocket site was steam powered?
Yeah, because at the time he'd hired a guy who was a rocket designer, and the simplest thing that they could build for the money that he had was steam powered. I mean, could he have built a NASA style rocket that would have flown him over the camera? Yeah, but those things are super goddamn expensive.
Yeah, you're not
with
gonna
all
get
the
your money back
fuel
off of that.
And everything else. So steam power water, you know, I mean,
when I think of steam powered though, all I keep thinking about, you know, did you have one of those rockets when you're a kid, like you put water in and then you pump them full of air.
Pump them up, right?
Right.
And they fly up. That's what I think of when I think like he had just a bigger version of that, essentially.
Well, but it's heated. That's where the steam comes from. So, but yeah, maybe what you're talking about is air pressured versus what he was trying with steam. And I don't know which one of those would have been better because as we all know now, you know, 40 years later, this was not a good stunt.
Now, it could have worked. I think there's a lot of ways it could have worked.
Sure. Just not any of the ways he tried.
No.
Yeah.
He milked it for all it was worth. Yeah. So ultimately, the attempt took place in September of 1974, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you're doing research on something like this, I always stumble across who knows what. I came across an album that was released in early 1974 called Evel Knievel.
No.
Yeah. It features a song called The Ballad of Evel Knievel, all this stuff.
Oh, she had a ballad.
But the interesting thing about this record is that it has several voice tracks. One of them is a press conference with Evel Knievel. So you get to hear him in his voice in the date leading up to this. And this album clearly came out just before the attempt. And there is a cut on there that's about 20 minutes long of him talking to a bunch of school children about the things he's afraid of. And, you know, they ask, are you afraid? How many bones you broke? You know, it's kids asking questions.
Right, right.
It's the most kind-hearted I've ever heard him be with these kids. One thing is I know he knows he's being recorded, so he's going to be nice.
Right.
But he actually was like being kind to kids about, you know, wear your helmet and be brave. Don't be stupid and stuff like that.
He was kind of a PSA guy when he was doing stunts. Yep. Like there's plenty of times where he would say you talked about that helmet thing. I remember in the movie, there was a scene where he says, you know, to kids, Evel Knievel always wears his helmet and you should too.
Yep. Yeah.
Because, you know, that was kind of always an argument amongst motorcycle riders, right? I don't want to wear my helmet. It makes me feel not free. I don't know how it makes you feel not free.
Messes up my hair or whatever. He knew that people were going to emulate him, kids especially.
Right.
So he's like, well, the least I can do is tell them to be safe if you're going to do it. Because they're going to do it. Kids are going to be kids.
Yeah.
He did a bunch of shady shit to get to do what he wanted to do. But when it came to talking with kids, you're right. He seemed to want to hold up the American ideal. I think that was a very important thing for him because he was a devout American in every sense of that word. He was American. You know,
he
loved the country and he wanted to portray good American wholesome ideals to those children.
He looked like an American flag. He was covered with red, white, and blue stars and stripes. Yeah.
Yeah.
He took that serious.
And this event, I mean, he promoted the crap out of it. I mean, he even hired like a guy who promoted Muhammad Ali to help with the PR on this. I remember in the movie, he had like the rocket, the prototype he would take around and show people. And he was on different talk shows and all that stuff. Mm. Apparently, you only watch it on closed circuit TV.
Like early days of pay-per-view.
Yeah. That's making their money, I'm sure, that way.
Back then, though, it was like pay-per-view was you had to go to a theater or go someplace to see it because they couldn't send it to your homes. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting. It's probably new for back then. As the day approaches that the stunt actually comes up, I think that's where you start seeing all the chinks in the armor and all issues and all pressure. The problems.
Well, he was under pressure for one. And so any facade he had of kind of that showmanship, I'm sure he was under pressure to both people investing in him, to the stunt. He knows that he could die, obviously, more so than any other stunt.
Set the scene. So he didn't just do this on one day and a bunch of people showed up that day. Like, people came to the Snake River Canyon place and stayed there for a long period of time before the stunt ever even happened.
Right. He had test cycles that he would launch and try.
And he was kind of living in amongst that chaos that whole time. This man didn't have security set up.
Right.
It wasn't like, you know, if Jennifer Lopez goes to a concert having 50, you know, no neck people walking around her at all times, so nobody can really get to her unless she wants you to. This guy was just walking amongst all the people that were there, and the people that were there, this is right at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s when people were still, you know, let's all go to a field and sing Kumbaya and live together and do all that. But these were
that wasn't that crowd, really not
nice people that would want to go to the field because they did have a contingent of a group that was really mad at him already. The Hell's Angels were there.
Sure. They rolled into town and caused all kinds of chaos. So first of all, like you said, people started attributing that trouble. Knievel brought this problem to town,
right?
Which, true or false,
he kind of did. Yeah,
he was the catalyst for being there. Fair enough. Right. And then with all the stress that was on him, and plus the kind of guy he already was, he did not show him his best self in front of the press.
Right. Oh, no.
He was curt. Yeah. He was dismissive. He yelled at people. He bit their heads off.
Slapped cameramen.
Yeah.
Threw them out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing. Think about it, because he was shrewd, right? He knew that you have to win over the press. Like, that's like the people. And for him to do that, though, that's like, wow, he must have been under some serious stress to like...
Yeah.
Just blow it with the press.
2021, he gets canceled in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
1974, he still has a way, because there's no internet. That's not a lot of this stuff gets reported the day after, as you know, when it hits a paper or something like that.
And you hear it second and third report. You know, it's not like he went on and tweeted, this guy's an asshole.
Right.
You hear it from somebody, from somebody, from somebody. So you're not attributing it right to him. You're like, he had to know the impact it would have on his career, but it was too much. It was too much.
And none of his team was prepared for this. Like the guy, Mo, you said that he hired that promoted Ali boxing matches and stuff. That guy had no idea what to expect promoting this event. He didn't understand the people, the culture, motorcycles, any of that. He had no idea. He just knew we're going to have this event and a bunch of press there, and he's going to jump this game. And the rest of it was just, how can I get more money out of this for our group, for our team? Mm-hmm. And that was not the way to look at this event.
No, definitely not. After all this time, all this showboating, we come to the day, right? Mm-hmm. This is the day. The rocket bike cycle thing is on the, like, this 100-foot ramp.
The Wile E. Coyote Acme rocket, literally, oh my God, is on the ramp.
It looked like a Roadrunner skit. You're not kidding.
Right. The ramp was 10 stories tall. I mean, they were playing around. They needed lift.
So you guys saw the same ramp I did.
Yeah.
The angle of that thing was gave me confidence whatsoever that he was like going to make it across.
Like
he was going to break orbit, not go across a canyon.
Yeah. And John, actually, you were telling me about this. Like, he had like a dead man stick, right?
He did. Yeah. So he had this lever inside of the rocket, and it was an open canopy, by the way. There was a little shield, but it wasn't closed. And the idea was, should he pass out, which they thought he might, his hand would come off this switch and it would deploy the parachute. That's how the parachute got deployed.
Yeah, because it was essentially just a big spring on the bottom of the handle. If let go of the handle, the handle went forward and that deployed the chute.
Yep. So here we go. 3, 2, 1, liftoff. That rocket lifts, and you can watch in the footage now, the parachute opened almost the instant the rocket took off.
Yeah.
Yeah, like while it was still on the ramp.
Yeah, it was on the ramp, trailing behind all that steam and everything. Thing was this flapping parachute. It was already open. He got up in the air, that thing opened, he went right down to the river.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, you think, oh, he's got a parachute. It's still, even though it's controlled, that's a crash.
Right.
A horrible crash.
Yeah. In fact, they thought he would survive the crash, but the team thought they wouldn't get to him before he drowned.
Yeah.
Right. If he hit the
because
river.
Because he would get drug under with the parachute and with all that, with the heavy weight and everything. They said he might have survived the crash. We think he did, but can we get to him in time? Well, we're here in the future together, so we know he did not die. He did not drown. There's speculation as to what actually happened. Did he pass out? Did his hand slip? Did he decide he couldn't make it and survive and he let the parachute go?
Yeah.
Who knows?
I personally think it was a physiological response because the man was not trained like an astronaut would have been trained. He was not trained with centrifuges to be able to withstand G-forces. Mm-hmm. And that's what would happen on that rocket. Yeah. I mean, 4 or 5 G's he would have been pulling instantly. I'm 100% confident in saying that that would have likely made him black out and would have made him release. As soon as that rocket hit go, because it goes from 0 to 5 million miles per hour, whatever the speed was, you're going to black out.
Yep. But he survived. And I know there's a lot of controversy too about, okay, was it like a scam? Was it, a lot of people were pissed off really about, because it failed so quickly. I don't think they were expecting
there's almost
it.
No spectacle for it. It was like a mid-90s Tyson fight. You know, it was like,
you
pay $100 for pay-per-view and pop, 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 you're down. It's over. What did I pay for? Yeah, right. It was one of those deals.
Okay. So I'm going to give you guys a name. So tell me if you know who this is. Eddie Braun.
No idea.
Sounds like a lowlife. I have no idea who he is.
Well, Eddie Braun, to show you how much things have changed, in 2016, he did the Snake River jump.
Really?
Yep. In a similar rocket sled thing that Evel Knievel did.
Wow.
And he made it. He went the entire way across. And nobody knows
how many
about
people
it.
Care or know who Eddie Braun is. He wasn't Evel Knievel. It comes right down to it. He wasn't Evel Knievel.
That's kind of crazy. Like the person who actually does it and was like, you know, who cares?
That's just 5 years ago. And you expect that to have made
big news,
a
blip
somewhere. Yeah. Nope.
Nothing. Never even heard
nothing.
Of it.
Yep. Sorry, you're not Evel Knievel.
Just goes to show you what Eddie Braun lacked was the self-promotion that Evel Knievel didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least 2 traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.
If you're a diehard Gen X grown-up, you can pledge your support by clicking join on YouTube or by becoming a patron at genxgrownup.com/patreon.
After the canyon jump is over, I would like to retire for quite some time. I'd like not to have to live with that lump in my throat, that knot in my stomach like I have for 8 solid years. I'm looking forward to the day that that machine drops down on the other side of that canyon. I'm looking forward to the day that I can get out of it and grab 2 fistfuls of Idaho dirt and thank God Almighty I'm still alive. And come back across the other side and go home with my wife and kids and retire for a while.
You really nailed it a minute ago, George, when you were just saying the thing that Evel Knievel had, the special sauce, the magnetism, was the showmanship, the hustler. He knew how to sell himself, and nobody sold himself more in the mid-70s than Evel Knievel. We started seeing lines of toys and cartoons and everything based on Evel Knievel that every kid wanted.
Yeah,
I would say that without Evel Knievel, I don't know that marketing would have developed the same way
did.
People want to talk about Star Wars. Fuck Star Wars. Evel Knievel really was a guy who drove that stuff home. Because Star Wars is a movie about mythical characters and all this crazy stuff. Evel Knievel's one guy jumping shit on a motorcycle.
That's right. Just one
everybody
nutcase.
Wanted those damn toys.
Yep.
Yeah. I wanted the lunchbox. I wanted the stunt cycle.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted a cape around my body with the stars and stripes V that he had.
Yeah. Well, the Ideal Toy Company, starting in 72, released a series of Evel Knievel merchandise. During the 6 years the toys were made, they say they sold more than $125 million worth of Evel Knievel toys.
That sounds right.
Yep. Yeah.
In those days, dollars. I can imagine.
That's right. Yeah. $70. And they had figures, all kinds of outfits. The ones George wanted full size, but regular for the doll outfits.
He already has those.
It does. It, 73 was the Evel Knievel stunt cycle.
Oh my God.
Ooh. Yeah. After the release of that, they were the best selling item for Ideal Toys.
That damn commercial drove me nuts. I never had one. To this day, I want one. If any of our fourth listeners have one, send me one, please. I want one of those.
I had friends that had it. I never had one myself. My friends had one. I mean, the challenge was just making the damn thing work. I mean, it kind of was kind of crappy the way it worked, but every kid wanted one, and for somehow we still had fun. I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't have one. My next door neighbor had one. It worked fine as far as I could tell. It was built like a little tank, too. You put it on that little ramp, you crank the hell out of it, and then you let it go, and look, so the pegs are going to break off, the steering, handlebars are going to break off, but the core of that thing was dense. You could run that thing into a tree and it was going to be fun.
I wanted to do the one stunt they had in the commercial where they send him off and he's standing like a headstand on the handlebars.
Yeah,
and
right.
You go underneath the bench and the bench hits his legs and flips him back onto the that's the stunt I wanted to do when I was a kid.
Yeah, I think if they had a commercial today, they would say, do not try this or this is not real or something like that.
Right.
Back then, though, they didn't have to worry about that.
Digitally commercial may appear much easier than they really are.
We did 2,000 takes to get that one thing working.
Well, after the stunt cycle, during the next 4 years, Ideal put out a lot more stuff, Evel Knievel touring show.
Mm-hmm.
There was a van you could get and all kinds of different kits and trailers and stuff. There was even a Robbie Knievel doll.
Yeah, the blue jumpsuit, right? Yeah, the blue one.
Was he a kid or was he a full-grown adult?
He was smaller
like a teenager. Evel
Knievel. Yeah, okay. Teenager. Yeah.
And a stunt car and the whole Evel Knievel stunt world, they called it. All these things.
I remember the dragster.
Yeah.
Yeah, yep.
That's the one I remember.
Yep.
After the cycle, I remember the dragster the most.
It was just whatever, right? They started putting out non-Evel Knievel related toys, like a chopper motorcycle and a trail bike and a female counterpart for Evel Knievel called, wait for it, Dairy Daring.
Oh, Lord. That's terrible.
Trying to fit.
Yeah, did they ever do a Snake River Rocket toy? They must have, right?
No, nothing I know of. I don't think they did the X2.
I guarantee you he wouldn't have let anybody do that one. He was embarrassed by that stunt. So I bet he wouldn't have allowed that because he was very full of it. Like, he didn't want his image hurt by anything, and that stunt went horribly.
Yeah. Yeah, it did.
The last thing that Ideal made in the Evel Knievel line was this Stratocycle that was based on the George Hamilton film, Viva Knievel, from that movie.
Geez.
That was the last thing they put out.
Oh, jeez.
Mm.
Did you know they had a Saturday morning cartoon, too?
I did.
Yeah. I did not know that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember that as a kid.
Evel had no involvement in it, but it was on ABC on Saturday mornings by Hanna-Barbera just for one season in the fall of 74. Yep.
Wow.
Fun days.
I don't remember that at all. I guess it didn't do very well, huh?
One season.
One season. Well, everything was a cartoon. If it was popular, it was a cartoon back then. They would throw anything at the wall and see what stuck. There's another one that's worth noting here. Just one more is in 77, Bally put out this Evel Knievel pinball machine.
Oh. Yes.
That's a nice pinball machine, by the way.
It is. It's beautiful.
They labeled it the first fully electronic commercial game.
Really?
Yeah. It's one of the last pre-digital games, they say. Yep.
Wow.
Yep. Only about 155 made of the electromechanical version.
Imagine what that's going for now.
I don't even want to know. But I've definitely played it. I've played the one that's probably not as rare.
If I had a giant warehouse for an arcade, that's a pinball I would want.
You'd have that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that machine came out, as I said, in 1977, which was pretty much the tail end of his performing career as Evel Knievel. I think 75 was his last big jump we had talked about a little while ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all of his promotional things and his agreements were starting to break down. I think Ideal wasn't doing stuff anymore with him. I think a lot of it was because of the damage to his reputation. He had, Snake Canyon we talked about. He got in a fight with that one guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, not just a fight. I mean, the reporter he got in a fight with, but then his own publicist who had publicized the whole Snake River Canyon thing, he attacked him on a Hollywood set with a damn baseball bat.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Because of a book.
He had told the guy, you can write a book, and the guy wrote a book, and it was not like a flattering book at all.
Which means it was probably accurate.
Right.
Yeah.
So he attacked the guy, and it was a big media thing, so big and drew so much controversy. And he even admitted guilt during the trial and went to jail.
Yeah, yeah.
That Ideal Toy Company and all the other people, they just left him behind.
Yeah.
They just said, we can't be associated with this person anymore.
What was supposed to be his last stunt was supposed to be January 31st in 77, where you mentioned this before, he's supposed to jump over sharks, literally.
Yeah.
He's jumping 90 feet over a tank of 13 sharks.
Mm.
And during one of his practice jumps, he actually crashed and and fractured more stuff, and he never did the stunt. Like, scrapped it. He never went back to it. And that was pretty much the end at that point.
He just kind of went on a downward spiral, mostly. All of the bad juju that he had generated over the years with people started to catch up with him. He was not kind to his family, to his wife. He stepped out on her quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Openly.
He made tons of money, and he was ostentatious with his expenditure of money.
Oh,
and just
whatever, crazy
furs and diamonds and stuff.
And not necessarily for her.
No.
For the other women.
Well, yeah. And for him. And for him, too.
And for himself, yeah. You're right, yeah.
He wasn't giving back any, which is a thing that, like, you know, he paid lip service, like, yeah, hey, thank you, Harley Davidson, kids wear a helmet. He wasn't going and, you know, teaching kids about bike safety or anything. He was just...
Wasn't doing a lot of charity type of work.
No, nothing like that. He was really going down a spiral. And just, as you said, he just wasn't a good guy. He tried to pull it out of the nosedive toward the end of his life a little bit, though.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, he went around and he almost did like the 12-step routine a little bit, like where he went around to people trying to make amends, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And he would go to his wife, I'm very sorry for all the things I did. Mm-hmm. And he ended up marrying another young lady later in his life, or I don't know if they got married or she just was with him, but she took care of him throughout his dying days.
Yeah.
And you know, Robbie, his son, and he had another son too as well. They love their father, but you can tell in interviews that they understood who he was and they weren't happy about it. For such a large icon of our youth, as we all said, you know, when you're kids, that guy, he looked like a superhero. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should ask the question, John, how do we feel about him now that we're adults, based on what we've learned throughout all the research and the documentaries and the fact digging and checking and whatnot? So, John, I'm going to start with you. How do you feel about this man now?
You know, I didn't have a really firm attachment to him as a kid. I just knew he was this larger than life guy. I always wanted to see what he was going to do. So luckily he wasn't like an idol that I worshiped, and to learn these things about him didn't crush an image that I had necessarily. I think about him as a more real person now. I think he was a guy who was not mentally equipped to handle the kind of fame that he got, and he just couldn't manage it. I think he was not a good guy in general, but anyone with that kind of money and fame and pressure thrust upon them, I don't know how many people would handle that really, really well, being the single point of failure. It's not like you're on a team. It's not like you're on a squad. You're one guy.
Right.
And so I pity him a bit. I think he had a really, really tough go of it. I admire the things he was able to accomplish. The huckster in him, I respect, but also despise, because he was really tricking a lot of people to get what he got. But by God, he did it. So I give him credit for that. So I just kind of feel bad for the guy, mostly.
Mm. Mo, how about you?
Yeah, you know, John, I kind of agree with you. It's like, as an adult, especially now, you look back and you know that everybody's has problems and flaws and all that stuff.
Sure.
And the thing is, though, I could still admire the guy, flaws and all, because he was a human being. So he obviously had a lot of weaknesses, especially with all the money, like you said, and drinking and women and all that stuff that he just kind of went nuts with. But, you know, when it came down to it, I don't think that diminishes what he did accomplish. Mm-hmm. And I guess I kind of talked about like some of the stuff we do here, like with the cancel culture and everything else right now. Does something you learn about the person that's bad discount everything they've done in their life? And in this case, you know, I don't think it does. I think he was a flawed person. But like you said, he was a huckster, but he delivered, right? It wasn't like he was a huckster and left town before the day of the stunt or something like that. You know, he actually delivered it. Like you said, I think I feel bad for the guy. I think if he was a little better managed or a little bit, you know, he wouldn't be jumping today, but, you know, he'd still maybe be around and talking about it, promoting stuff or things like that.
George, what about you? You teed this up for us. So now that you know everything you know, what do you think about him?
You know, I'm probably going to get a little too personal here since this is a podcast, you know, and maybe my family won't appreciate this as much. But I think I have a bit of a unique perspective on it, only because I see way too many similarities between Evel Knievel and my own father.
Oh, wow.
And so I think I kind of have a little bit of a similar viewpoint that Robbie and his other children might have. I love my father. I'm not going to say that I didn't. My father holds a special place in my heart. He's been passed for many years now, but I didn't love who my father was.
Mm-hmm. I get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it. I
understand.
Evel Knievel was a very similar profile. He grew up dirt poor, having to scrap and steal and do whatever he had to survive in Butte, Montana. My father did it in Kentucky. They were very similar people growing up. They had a lot of the same pressures put on them to take care of themselves and the people around them. when that happens to a person, you can do one of two things. You can either go about things the right way, or you can go about things the wrong way. And I think both of them chose the wrong way. I think they both accomplished great things. You know, Evel Knievel became this legendary stuntman. My father was a legendary pool hustler, as well as opened up several multi-million dollar businesses with nothing more than a seventh grade education. Mm-hmm. He didn't treat me and my mother well, just like Evel Knievel didn't treat his family or his wife well. Mm. And yet I still feel that the man supported us in the only way he could, which was by supporting himself first. Mm. And I think that's what Evel Knievel was really about. It wasn't that he was an evil person, not to use his name in the other sure. context, but right. I think at his core, he did want to take care of his wife, his children, the women that he stepped out with. But the only way he could do that and not break down mentally was by making himself large enough to be able to support them in mm-hmm. the shadows of his glory. And that's the way I see Evel Knievel. It's the way I see my father. And I think that there's no way to give a clear-cut black or white answer. Was he a good guy? Was he a bad guy? Mm-hmm. Because he's really kind of both.
He was being the only man he could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's who he was. That just happened to be superstar, death-defying hero to billions, stuntman, Evel Knievel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Or my dad. Either
or
one.
Your dad. Either thank you for that. That's very touching and personal. Yeah. You share that with us and our audience. Yeah. I knew your dad. I cared very much for him as well. And I see those similarities. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. So I can see how they could touch you. I don't think there's much more that can be said that is any more poignant than how we just sealed it off yeah. there. It's a great look back at the life and legacy of Evel Knievel. Had a lot of fun doing that with you guys. I hope everyone who wanted to hear it is satisfied now that you've got your Evel Knievel fix. We sure enjoyed doing it for you. Before we end the show, I want to take just a quick second anytime there's any new or notable supporters. And I want to call out Stew Monkey, a longtime patron who has supported us for years. He paused his Patreon membership a few months ago because mm-hmm. he was at ground zero of Hurricane Ida.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Mm, right.
He wrote us and said, no need to do this. He wrote us and said, hey, I'm going to suspend my Patreon. I don't know what's going to happen. Flooding, you know, terrible things are happening. I'm like, dude, take care of yourself.
You need
no
to,
problem.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
We're here for you. He wrote me just the other day and said, hey, by the way, I'm reinstating my Patreon membership. Things are coming back. We don't have TV and internet at our home yet, but I wanted to get back supporting you guys.
He's supporting us before he could even watch us or listen to us.
I'm telling you what, he thought we were an essential service to support Gen X Grown Up. I can't tell you how flattering that is. Stew Monkey, we have always appreciated your love and support over here. We hope you and your family and everybody in the region over there are doing well after the hurricane. And thanks again for your humbling show of support for Gen X Grown Up.
Wow.
Means the world
That's
to us.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. Thanks, buddy. We appreciate that. All right, that is going to wind it up for this edition of The Backtrack. We're going to be back in 2 weeks with another one, of course, and next week is a regular edition of our show. Until then, I am John. George, thank you so much for being here, man.
Yes, sir.
Mo, you know I appreciate you.
Always fun, man.
Fourth listener, though, it's you we all appreciate most of all, and we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
See you guys.
Take care, everybody.
Gen X Grown Up is a member of the Evergreen Podcast family. Learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com. No more watching shows till sunrise. Unacceptable for grown-ups. Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up. Chad listened to that episode, and he wrote in to say... I had to burp. Excuse me.
Wow.
That's not what he
wonder
said.
Why he would tell us that. Yeah.
He must have been dictating.
Transcribed. No. Okay.
We all did some research for this and fucking.
Oh, Alexa.
Forgot about that thing.
Feed the fish. Wonder what she thought you said. Who knows?
No. It's a reminder to feed the fish at 6 o'clock.
Oh, gotcha. Oh, now mine heard me say yours.
Hi, this is comedian and writer, and let's be honest, I do a lot of things. This is Dean Archipotis, the host of Whiskey Business, the podcast not so much about whiskey as it is one with whiskey. Yes, we drink and talk about whiskey, but we do so much more with so many interesting people. For example, we talk to comedians like Greg Warren.
You know, I don't want to brag, but let's just say I can walk into a Red Lobster and get whatever. You know, I think the pause right there is probably more important than the word.
Amazing athletes like boxing champion Buster Douglas.
When a fighter's down and he's looking for his mouthpiece instead of trying to get up.
That's when I knew it was over.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And yes, Bigfoot chasers.
Do you believe in Bigfoot? And if so, does he really eat beef jerky?
The Bigfoot thing is people have seen these, and I've seen a lot of compelling evidence about it.
It's Whiskey Business with Dino Tripodis. Join us for what we call a good conversation with a good pour. You really can't ask for much more than that, can you, people? Check us out at WhiskeyBusinessPod.com, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.